This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by the Civic Engagement Podcast, Future Hindsight. Join host Mila Atmos this week as she sits down with Colin Jarolmack, author of Up to Heaven and Down to Hell. They discuss the impacts of fracking on small town communities, how this form of gas extraction actually hurts our democracy and civic life. It's available wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com. Now for this show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 14th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, President of the U.S. Middle East Project, Daniel Levy, will be joining us. Also on the program today, Noah Colwin, co-creator of the podcast Blowback. Meanwhile, violence continues as the U.S. blocks a U.N. discussion on a ceasefire. As of yesterday, 49 new Palestinian deaths. CDC, I should say civilian deaths. CDC issues new recommendations. Fully vaccinated may go without masks in all but a very few places. However, mask mandates remain in place in many Democratic states as they reevaluate. Ron Wyden reveals the DOD is surveilling Americans without warrants. Project Veritas, former spy, and Eric Prince mounted a special operations aimed at Trump enemies in the Trump administration. And I was able to say that entire sentence without laughing out loud. Republican congressman from Colorado sued by a former staffer after turning his congressional office into essentially a COVID petri dish. Meanwhile, group of leading scientists call for a proper investigation into the COVID origins, cite the possibility of a lab leak. Republican-led states plan to cut employment benefits for nearly 2 million Americans. And lastly, the Missouri voters passed a Medicaid expansion. And its Republican governor says, so what? All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you today?
Hi, it's Friday and it's nice here. It's nice out.
It is very nice. 60s. It feels like the beginning of summer or like deep into spring. It's been a little chilly for spring.
Yeah, you know, and so because we are New Yorkers, we can never be fully happy. This is like the only time of the year. There's probably around 6 weeks total where we can be happy about the weather. And then as soon as it hits June, it's way too hot to be in the city and we'll go back to complaining.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like to think that I complained in all the places I've ever lived. So
it's poetic.
I maintain that consistency. Today on the program, this a slight a deviation from our typical format. Usually we have a commentator on to just discuss broadly the week in review. But this week we have Daniel Levy on. I have been talking to Daniel Levy about Israel specifically in terms of its treatment of Palestinians and the potential for any type of peace for well over a decade. And so I wanted the opportunity to talk to him and get his perspective on this. He was involved in the Oslo Peace Accord negotiations. I think he is a slightly jaundiced view of some of those negotiations, but nevertheless, he has a great insight. He will be joining us shortly. But before we get there, there's a couple of dynamics that are going on that are, I think, in some ways, somewhat unique in terms of this round, if you will, of, and I don't want people to misunderstand me when I say round, because obviously there has been ongoing suppression of the Palestinian people and their rights for decades. But there are moments where the, at least in the context of the United States, it becomes a news item. It is pegged on some events, a new round of violence, extreme violence, and this is one of them. And what is unique about this a moment are two things, it seems to me. One is what is happening within Israel proper. There are many people, commentators in Israel, and of course we're not there, so it's hard to assess. But certainly from this distance, it looks different. There is what some people argue is like what could be like a burgeoning civil war within Israel. The Israeli Arab population is somewhere around 20 some odd percent. And for the most part, Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews have lived together in there's been a peaceful coexistence within the country. I'm sure there are incidences, but
within the country is key, because that 20%, like the 700K odd Palestinian Arabs, that's distinct for our viewers from the occupied Palestinians.
Yes, we're not talking about the occupied territories. I'm talking about actual folks who presumably have Israeli citizenship and the rights are afforded to them in that regard. They're Israeli citizens and they're living within Israel as opposed to the occupied territories. And there have been reports all throughout the country of acts of violence between Arab Israelis and Jewish Israelis. There have been mob violence, right-wing Jewish groups that have, we talked about this yesterday, smashed the windows and some Palestinian-owned businesses. It has gone, both directions in terms of the violence, but there is which is not to say that they're equal. I'm not equating them. I'm just simply saying there is growing violence there. And there is, some commentators are saying this is how you get to a civil war. And the other thing that is unique, it seems to me, in this instance, Ryan Grimm had a piece that captured this yesterday in The Intercept, that we are seeing more prominent elected voices in this country, primarily in the Democratic Party, who
singularly
are speaking,
in the Democratic Party.
Well, singularly. I mean, I'm just thinking back if there's ever been like a Buchanan Republicans who really didn't like Israel, but more because of the Jewish problem.
Jewish element. I mean, Bush, I guess, in 2001 sort of pushed back, and Biden was to the right of him, actually, when you look back on Israel. But I mean,
I'm not sure about that, but we could talk about that, maybe in that moment. I'm not sure, but be that as it may, the real point is that you have many voices, or at least some voices and prominent ones in the Democratic Party, speaking out on behalf of Palestinian rights this time around. Here is Ilhan Omar. And there was a speech on the floor from AOC. We saw a speech on the floor from Rashida Tlaib that was incredibly moving. She and Tlaib is Palestinian. Here is Ilhan Omar calling out the United States for blocking a UN ceasefire request.
Defending Israel's airstrikes against civilians under the guise of self-defense, without even a mention of the children getting killed, much less what happened at Al-Aqsa or in Sheer Jarrah. When the 15-member United Nations Security Council proposed a resolution this week calling on the Israeli government to cease settlement activities, demolition and eviction, and urging general restraint, the United States reportedly blocked it from happening. We are currently blocking the United Nations Security Council from calling on ceasefire. And to this day, we as members of Congress have not had yet a hearing or a briefing on this conflict, or gotten answers on whether our weaponry or money is being used to commit human rights abuses. So I must ask, when we defend Israeli citizens' right to peace and security, how can we at the same time ignore the 5 million Palestinians living under occupation? When we say that Israel has the right to self-defense, how can we ignore the home demolitions, settlement violence, and forced annexation of Palestinian land that is happening? And how can we say they themselves do not have the right to defend themselves? How can we pay lip service to a Palestinian state yet do absolutely nothing to make that state a reality while the Israeli government we fund tries to make it impossible? I will end with this. Today is Eid, the final day of Ramadan, one of the joyous days in the Muslim calendar. And while I would rather be spending it with my family, I know there are families who are mourning the death of their children because of this. And I owe it to them to speak out on their behalf. So I am here today to stand for our common humanity, to say that every child deserves a life free of violence and oppression. Every child deserves advocates for their humanity.
This is a change that, you know, exists, and it is a hopefully a trend. But what the administration is doing, we'll talk more about with this Daniel Levy, what the administration is doing by holding off on any calls for a ceasefire or any conversations at the UN is essentially, I mean, let's be very clear on this. It is to give the Israelis time to do as much damage as possible. That is it. There is no other explanation for this whatsoever. And they know, and you can see it as this develops, they know that every day goes by, the ledger of Palestinians killed goes up at a much, much faster rate than any casualties that Israel will suffer or any type of physical damage, right? I mean, they are going in to take out any progress that has happened in Gaza in any infrastructure, whether it's energy or food or whatever it is. That's what the agenda of the Israelis is. It is to punish the Palestinian civilian population.
It is to discipline them as well. How dare you demand that you have rights? How dare you demand that you have access to electricity, to clean water? How dare you demand some form of statehood that isn't completely under our thumb? How dare you retaliate when we, on two consecutive days, storm one of the holiest places when you're worshiping for a holiday the Alaska Mosque. How dare you have a response to that? No, no, no. You are supposed to be our subjects and nothing more. And that's exactly the response in the United States is abetting it. They are blocking the United Nations, as of yesterday, their call for a ceasefire to give Israel more time to kill more children, more civilians. Yesterday was the bloodiest day. Now the death total is over 100. It varies, but at least 27 children have been killed. And just to remark on Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, I doubt we'll get to it right now, but I would encourage everyone to watch her full speech. She cried. Her and Ilhan Omar are two of the most remarkable people in Congress, specifically on this issue right now, based on the fact that they were both the two first Muslim women to be in Congress, and they have that lived experience. Rashida Tlaib is Palestinian. Ilhan Omar obviously is a refugee. So just treasure the fact that these two people are able to be given voices in government, however marginalized they are by the media and by the rest of their colleagues.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. When we come back, we'll be talking to Daniel Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Project. Folks, the show today is sponsored by SunsetLakeCBD.com. You've heard me talk about them many, many times before, but I want to highlight this. One of the things that, I really do, I use their product daily. Just about daily. Five times a week, I'm trying to get to sleep with the tincture. And I use the Solve, and I'll occasionally use a smokable. But the thing that I really appreciate about these guys is that they are what I call a movement sponsor of this show. They were fans of the program, but they're up there running their business in about as good of a way as you can in the context of capitalism. You take that for what you want, but they have mostly employee owned. They pay a minimum of $15 an hour. Their farming practices, no pesticides, integrated pest management, regenerative farming practices. All of that is great, but they do stuff like this, which is really great. One of the executive director, a guy named Sam, wrote to my sister and who helps us with advertising and whatnot. And she says, I hope you're well. Just want you to let you know there's a nurses' strike going on in St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts. Now, I don't know that they know this, but my sister was actually born there. And the nurses have been on strike since March 7th. We've talked about this. It's going into day 50. They are demanding adequate staffing levels, essentially for patient safety. There were 600. They filed 600 notices of patient of problems with patient safety over the course of the last year. During that year, the hospital owner, it's a Texas hospital conglomerate, Tenet Healthcare, made over $400 million in profit. They have made $97 million in profit this quarter. Nurses are on strike for better safety protocols for their patients. Tenet just announced yesterday that they're going to bring in permanent scabs for these nurses. There's about 700 that are on strike. And Sunset Lake has donated $2,500 to the nurses' strike fund. They want to encourage MR listeners to help if they can. We have put the link on. I put it up on Twitter. We'll put it in our podcast description. It is a bit.ly link, bit.ly/ST for St. Vincent Nurses. But you can find that on our link. Donate something. They're going to need support as a tenant says that they're bringing in permanent scabs. But this is the type of company they are. Their product is great. They just sent me a lotion. I don't know how much I'm going to use it. I'm not a lotion guy. I use the salve. But if the lotion works like the salve does on some of my dry skin, then I'm into it. But check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. If you use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, they will give you 20% off of anything. The gummies, the CBD coffee, the CBD fudge. It's a great company. And also support the nurses. A very important strike, 700 of them. And there's a whole story behind, and maybe I'll talk about it at another point, about the merger of for-profit hospital companies and Catholic hospitals that is worth talking about. Also, this program is sponsored today by Hello Tushy. They have written this copy. I am not reading this. Despite the fact, you know, masks off and there's all
Wait, is this the copy you read to me before?
Yeah.
Not oh good. My God. Everyone brace your
No, I'm not going to. I'm not going I'm not going to say that part of it. I'm just not going to. But I mean, people can use their imagination. they like to get edgy, but the bottom line is the Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is a hit. Some people were on it about on Twitter the other day saying how much they love it. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is easy to install. It saves you cheap ass money. As they say, Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself with a smart spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't need any electricity. You don't need any extra plumbing. You cut your toilet paper use in by 80%. It pays for itself in a few months. Much less expensive than you imagine. Bidets can be thousands of dollars. This is not even close. Plus, Hello Tushy has you covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers right now. Clean your butt with every flush. Folks, it is a life-changing experience to switch to a bidet. Trust me on this. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. All right. I want to welcome to the program or back to the program, President of the U.S. Middle East Project, Daniel Levy. Daniel, it is great to see you again. I'm here with Emma Viglin. Thanks for coming.
Really good to see you, Sam. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Daniel.
So here we are again. We have had conversations. I was telling the audience early, probably over the course of, I don't know, the past 10 or 15 years. And on this, you know, each time we talk, it seems more and more intractable. I am struck, and I read the piece that you wrote about Biden's old playbook will not end the violence going on there. Let's talk about that. But then I want to talk about a couple of other sort of, I think, fairly new developments in the context of this, both what's happening internally in Israel and what's happening in the U.S. Congress. Both those things seem very different. But let's start with what Biden is doing. There are many reports that his administration is standing in the way of the U.N. trying to issue a call for a ceasefire. Give me a sense of what you think Biden wants to do, is doing, and what's problematic about it.
I mean, look, first, you know, you said something in those comments, Sam, which I think is interesting and that we shouldn't lose sight of through this conversation. And you said that each time we talk, you know, with heights of several years, it gets more intractable. And that's important because that is part of the problem, that each time after a period of neglect, people go, oh, it's blown up again. We've got to wrap our arms around this. We are doing so where the circumstances and conditions have further deteriorated. The ability to intervene effectively and the nature of the outcome one could achieve suffer from a diminishing return with each iteration. Now, I think the Biden administration came into office hoping that this would be an issue that they could back burner for as much as, if not all, of this term. And although the issue, I wouldn't argue for it to have priority, but they should know better because they've been there before. And they know how that if you don't get ahead of the curve, this has an explosive potential. And then given the extent of American equities in this issue and given the way this plays out in American politics, it's going to be very time consuming. So I understand that there is going to be inconsistency and hypocrisy in how America conducts itself in different parts of the world. There is going to be one standard that one applies to Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs, and there's going to be another standard that one applies to Narendra Modi's BJP regime and how it treats folks in Kashmir. However, an administration that has so pinned its colors to the mast of America is back, and being back means democracy, values, norms, international law. Do you really want to be so out on a limb when it comes to Israel's treatment of the Palestinians? And so I would like to see an administration that appreciates, number one, that there is a place on the spectrum between maximum pressure and maximum impunity. You know, it's not a binary. You can look at Israel and say, you know, we're not putting you in that category. But maximum impunity has had a terribly distorting impact on the Israeli internal discourse and debate and the politics. And if you want to start getting this right, you have to introduce elements of accountability into how you relate to Israel and into that bilateral relationship. And secondly, give some breathing space in the multilateral fora. So there's things you can do in your bilateral relationship, and then there's things you can stand aside and not prevent in multilateral fora. Now, a UN call for a ceasefire, the statement that was prevented by America, in and of itself, isn't going to change everything. But the political signal you sent,
right,
by preventing it versus not preventing it, that's where the Israelis go, oh, good, it's business as usual, we can get away with anything.
Well, you, Sam mentioned it, and then you expanded upon how intractable the situation's become, right? And it gets more so with every passing year. Can you expand upon how these political choices, like the one we're seeing with Biden attempting to halt this UN call for a ceasefire, and just the knowing message that sends, the green light that it gives to Joe Biden, I mean, to Israel and Netanyahu, how that has contributed and how it almost seems to have exponentially escalated over the past few decades, the frequency with which we encourage this behavior?
Yeah, and I would also throw into the mix that it was on steroids during the Trump administration. So, first of all, you're not starting from point zero. You're dealing now with an Israel that is testing the water on just how different from the egregious excesses of Trump this next period is going to be. And you have to wrap your head around, there's no, as you both implied, there's no status quo ante. There's no pre-Trumpian golden era where America was getting this right that you can return to. And I do, look, let me first of all say that Israelis, and especially Israel as the occupying power, but Israelis and Palestinians, even as an occupied people, they carry primary agency and primary responsibility, not the US. But I would, with great confidence, assert that American policy has a huge shaping influence on the parameters of the politics especially in a polity like Israel. So in that respect, I think Israel not only got used to the idea that there was zero accountability, that there are no costs or consequences for whatever you do to the Palestinians. And given that, first of all, if you're a right-wing Israeli who believes in greater Israel, believes the Palestinians have no place there, who increasingly articulates this position, by the way, you had a member of Knesset who was a member of Netanyahu's government, if Netanyahu forms a government again, will be again, Bezalel Smotrich, stand on the podium of the Knesset the other day and talk to the Arab members of Knesset and say, you guys are here for now. Palestinian Israelis are here for now. Threatening expulsion, which of course the Palestinians have had in the past. So that's, if you're on the right, this is fabulous. It's cost-free. If you believe that, you know, this isn't going so well, we need to treat the Palestinians with some respect, some dignity, you know, permanent occupation isn't ultimately going to work out well for us, then you know that's going to be really difficult. You know, internally, that's going to be a huge fight. If you can simply carry on and say, you know what, we can postpone that because there's no cost. Again, there's no cost or consequence. Then it makes it so much more difficult to shift the dynamics in Israel. But I would say that I think, at least, irrespective of what Biden does almost, something very important has changed in the last few days. And I think it's the implosion of the concept that took deep root under Trump, which is as follows. I think the Israeli political class, across much of the spectrum, starting with the right, though, began to start believing in their own PR BS. And the narrative, the mantra was, the Pala what? The Palestinians? You still talk about those guys? That's yesterday's story. Nothing's going to happen with them. We've got this under control. You're talking from anachronistic talking points. The Arabs have accepted us. We've got peace with the Emiratis and with others. The Palestinians are eventually just going to have to accept whatever we give them. And those are going to be terms of surrender that will be dictated to them. I think that imploded in Israeli faces in the last days, not only what we've seen out of Gaza, which is very significant in terms of the rocket fire, but what we've seen inside Israel with the unbelievable unrest on the streets of towns and villages with Jewish extremist mobs, often backed by the power of the state, confronting Palestinian protesters, what we saw in Jerusalem, which led up to this. So, and today, by the way, things have spread to the West Bank. People have approached the border with Jordan. So I think the concept of the right has faced a challenge and has crumbled in ways that I didn't think we would see so quickly, which is good news. The question is, does this administration, from an American perspective, does this administration use that as an opportunity to revisit some things?
Just so that we have a historical context, I mean, it seems to me that we've had sort of like this this degradation of the United States' role. And look, yes, the primary agency lies with the Israelis and the Palestinians, and of course, with that, you know, with the qualification that the Israelis are clearly in the driver's seat here, right? I mean, they have all of the power, and it seems to me the United States has two obligations, you know, obviously, or three. I mean, obviously, just sort of the sheer moral one. But A, we contend that we want world leadership. This is where if you're going to put yourself into that arena and make that claim, then you've got to take that leadership. And B, we fund the Israelis to nearly $4 billion a year. And plus, I would say there's even, it goes beyond that. We have 35 states in this country, which you cannot teach in a public school if you participate in a boycott and divestiture movement. That is obscene in and of itself, regardless of what the country is. But we have all of these other built-in sort of like non-dollar value that we are in protecting. And what we're doing is we are basically enabling Israel's worst impulses. It started, it seems to me, with the Bush administration in terms of basically just, you know, I have no doubt that there was some vestige of that during the Clintons, et cetera, prior to that. But it was really the Bush administration, which became like more of a, instead of being a ballast for to stop the Israeli excesses, it became a sort of a force to push in that direction. And Obama did not do enough to rein that back in. Trump, as you say, put it on roids. And now we have a country that is like, they may not be being fed steroids by the United States, but they are still roided up. And for Biden to come in and assume that they can announce, we're not going to do anything here, and this wouldn't allow this to happen, to me, it seems like an incredible miscalculation. I mean, this is even this is assuming the best of intentions by the Biden administration, which, you know, I don't know what's in their minds. But this was a huge miscalculation, even from their own desire to not have this become an issue, because Netanyahu was going to do this. Let's talk about the other changes that you referred to in your piece, which is, because now this turns to like, you know, how do we influence the Biden administration to influence the Israeli government? Or how do we influence our government to influence the Biden administration? And you talked in your piece about the sort of, there are two distinct problems for this Democratic administration. You stated one, which was the idea of like, you're trying to project to the world that you're not Trump, but yet here you are doing nothing for the mess that Trump, you know, encouraged. Again, United States not the primary agent here, but you're not doing whatever it is that we can do within our realm of possibility. The other is a more sort of like domestic political issue. Will you discuss that? Because we started with a clip from Ilhan Omar at the beginning of the show, but we could see Rashida Tlaib. We could see AOC. Cori Bush. There are people speaking out in Congress like we haven't seen in this country ever.
I mean, first, I just feel that my steroids analogy was really inadequate after where you took it. So I'm going to double down on it like you did last time. This is fascinating to me and as someone who's worked in this for a long time. And I'm constantly trying to check myself and not get carried away, because it feels like the shifting of an Overton window in terms of how this is being dealt with inside the US. And yesterday felt really consequential, the speeches that you've just referred to, the session in Congress. Usual suspects, all the rest of it. But they weren't there saying the kinds of things that those folks said yesterday, saying them without fear. Some of those folks had already been reelected, having had a target put on their backs. And I literally had to pinch myself reading an item in the Times, in the New York Times this week, about Andrew Yang's candidacy for the mayoralty. How he had to retract and rephrase himself on Israel-related stuff because he had gone too far in ignoring the Palestinians and in asserting a singular right to self-defense and to security for Israelis. And this is the centrist candidate for mayor of New York. So, you know, if you want an indication of how this is shifting. Now, that's where I pause. This hasn't come out of nowhere, as you know, Sam. This has been movement building. This has been people working to de-exceptionalize Palestine, including in progressive spaces. This has been groups coming out of the Jewish community as well, saying we have to talk about this. We have to take this into the progressive community and support folks. And there's a range of those. So you've got JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, who are absolutely in this BDS racial justice space. You've got If Not Now, which is an insurgent group, younger generation. these are, to the extent to which JVP were always considered to be, you're Jewish when you criticize Palestine, when you criticize Israel, when you talk about Palestine, which I think was a harsh thing to say about those folks in the first place. But if not now, these are often the kids of the Macharocracy, of those who've been deeply involved in Jewish life, to have said, wait a minute, you brought me up with all of this stuff? That's not what it looks like to me. You sent me on this Israel trip. I've come back questioning all of this. And they've gone out and they've challenged who should be the anti-Semitism envoy. They've raised this issue as a JVP of conditionality of aid. And you've got J Street, which at the time didn't really have much to its left. But now it's kind of occupies that center space. And J Street came out supporting a bill put forward, initiated by Betty McCollum, about restricting the uses of American aid and assistance to Israel. And it's not going to accumulate a majority of members of Congress. It's not going to get passed as a bill. We're not there. But we see a shifting discourse. There is constituency and there are members of Congress who are responding to that. And the question is how far and how fast it goes, and whether the attempts of the other side are going to be effective in blocking those advances, and how many assists Israel is going to give. Because the other interesting phenomenon is that Israel keeps providing assists to this camp. It provided a huge assist when the Israeli leadership under Netanyahu decided, to hell with bipartisanship, I'm an ideological fellow traveler of Republicans. I'm an ideological fellow traveler of Trump, of the alt-right. We believe in a version of ethnic nationalist supremacism. We've got our natural allies over there. By the way, we have natural allies in Hungary with Viktor Orban and elsewhere. Let's partisanize this issue. Let's polarize the issue. And Democrats, not just the folks we've just been talking about, but Democrats would do well to smarten up and not allow this to be a divisive issue used against them by groups like the so-called Democratic Majority for Israel, by the Republican side. So the question is how effective the pushback would be. And you referred to one element of that pushback, which has been the attempt to criminalize criticism of Israel, criminalize BDS, and to weaponize anti-Semitism in ways that do a deep disservice and injustice to the actual fight against anti-Semitism. That made great progress. I see that also being effectively pushed back against. There was a statement put out by some of the most preeminent scholars of Jewish studies, contemporary Jewish history, anti-Semitism studies, just a couple of weeks ago, called the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which categorically protected free speech around Palestine and Israel issues and went against this so-called definition of anti-Semitism, which has attempted to criminalize BDS.
I'm sorry. Let me just want to follow up on this, because we had Nora Erekat on the program earlier this week, and she was talking in a way that I have that sounded new to me in terms of framing the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and in a way that comes out of, it seems, or at least is available, because there's a greater understanding in this country of the dynamic of white supremacy, of issues involving policing and the perception of an intersectionality, if you will, on some level. And it seems to me that the framing of the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, and maybe this has always gone on, but when I hear discussion of this in the news, it is, you know, I listen to the radio news for AP News just to hear how it's being what is the top line elevator pitch that they're making in terms of the news. And it's always Israel striking Hamas, as if Hamas was a place, as if Hamas was it is always, you don't hear Hamas is striking the Israeli government. right? Or the Israeli defense. It is Israel is hitting Hamas, as opposed to Israel is raining bombs on Palestinians. And there seems to be a consciousness now that, and again, we're all talking just like all rhetorically, right? There's no policy around here. This is all just sort of like foundational stuff that we're hoping will develop on it. But from a foundational perspective, this is a language and a rhetoric that at least broad swaths of the American public understands now, where you're talking about like this is a form of white supremacy that we're seeing. And, you know, it's not exactly like the way that it plays out in America, but it is, the dynamics are exactly the same. And that, except for it's far more brutal in some respects at this moment for the Palestinians. And I wonder if that is, I mean, how you see this is like, you know, from just a societal perspective, like there's a broader understanding, like even on Twitter, right? Like you have Palestinian voices on Twitter that just are not, the pushback is not the same. When I share these things on Twitter, I don't hear from the same people I used to hear. It just feels like there is a sea change that is happening, at least on the center to the left. And part of that is using Donald Trump as the fulcrum. Part of it is, I think, like this new awareness of this dynamic of white supremacy, and also just the ability to see these images of, like, you know, Israeli cops busting into a Palestinian home and just beating people so that they can get these homes for an Israeli settler. I mean, this is it just seems like there's a sea change here that we have yet to see it. The implications of it.
I think it's such an important insight by Noura, Erica, that because I think she's onto something, that it does feel that the leap forward in how the issue is discussed in America, it does feel derivative of a conversation that Americans have been having in an unprecedented way. It does feel that it took that wrapping one's head around racial justice and racial injustice and what it means, what white supremacism means, in order to better understand the Palestinian predicament. And this is where the blue chip Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, this is the case they have made in a recent report where they have come out and said, this is one regime of Jewish supremacy across the entirety of Israel and the lands it controls. And Human Rights Watch, the kind of global blue chip organization, came out and made the designation of Israel committing the crime of apartheid just last month. And, you know, in that context, to be on the wrong side of that issue as a Democrat should matter, and it may well begin to have sufficient constituency to matter and to exact a price. And so, I mean, I co-authored a report that we put out as US MEP and Carnegie a few weeks ago, which called for a rights-based approach. And I think centering these kinds of issues is the way to, as you say, it's foundational. It's shifting discourse. It's shifting narrative. The policy prescriptions are out there, but we'll come to those. Some of them may be more low-hanging fruit. We'll come to those. And, you know, I would just say this as well. I've lived in Israel. I took Israeli citizenship. I'm a dual national. I worked in the government there. It pains me to see how far things have gone in a negative direction. And I don't see how my friends over there who are working from this angle to change things, real change, deep fundamental change, I don't see how they make enough progress in doing that until the people they're trying to convince say, okay, we don't agree with you, but why are people suddenly ganging up on us? Why is this suddenly exacting a price in terms of what we thought was, everyone accepted it. We thought this was a perfectly acceptable way of going about. And then I think there might be openness for a conversation.
In other words, there needs to be an intervention. I mean, people need to be sat down and basically said, like, you're off the rails. And the, and the only way to indicate that is through things like BDS or the US government saying, hey, we're not funding this anymore.
Yeah. And holding them account, you know, you're held accountable, you're called out on it, where America directly contributes to it, it pulls back from that contribution, where there is legitimate criticism in an international fora that goes ahead without an American veto and going to a riff that you were on earlier. It's, of course, it's easy to come out and condemn your adversaries. You're only on the line when it's the folks who are your allies, who you fund, who are doing wrong. And then what do you do? That's the test case. That's whether you're walking the walk of America claiming it has a certain role on the international stage, or are you just bloviating?
You know, several years ago, I would get into fights, you know, email chains with I do that with a lot of people, but but specifically, it was a guy, an American Jew who, you know, had a whose position on Israel was like, you know, many American Jews, regardless of their political ideology broadly, which is essentially like Israel can do no wrong. Every situation, their actions are justified, et cetera, et cetera. And my argument was that, you know, if you have concerns about the viability of Israel long term, this is what you're doing by not holding them accountable for now is the greatest threat to the existence of Israel that could be. And I'm not even talking, you know, as a Jewish state, I'm saying like existentially, because it seems to me that the where this goes is that you get this type of dawdling by a Democratic administration. Maybe there's another 4 years of a Republican administration after this. I mean, I'm you know, 4 or 5, 10 years out, 20 years out, that we at one point, Israel will be, I don't know what, like I say, when it will become, will be as, if not more so, isolated than South Africa was. But the level of belligerence and this dynamic that you're talking about, where you have many Israelis going like, we don't see the problem here. I really worry about what that's going to look like 20 or 30 years if we're on this path. They are isolated, like in a dramatic fashion, with, you know, legit enemies around them, some anyways, that, when you wake up in the middle of the night and have this fear, like, what does that fear look like to you?
Well, I think. Just the last days have been a real rude awakening. The this is Hamas, okay? What they've managed to do already, just to paralyze life, scare Israelis. This is an organization which doesn't have a state, has a long-term blockade imposed on it from all directions. There are real limits to what you can smuggle through tunnels from Egypt into Gaza. Is basically making its weaponry in home factories. I mean, the idea that, you know, Iran is bringing great shipments in, how? I'm sure people are gaining some expertise from different places that they've been trained, but this is 2 million people in a tiny space, which Israel has under massive permanent surveillance, and this is the disruption they've managed to cause. You know, asymmetric warfare, should be, should be something that Israel at least pauses and says, is an exclusively military solution really the way forward? And this carries over to, for instance, Israeli opposition to the Iran nuclear talks, to the JCPOA. I have argued that Israel, that, and I again put impunity front and center here, that maximum impunity has been a terrible guide for Israeli strategic thinking. And, you know, I'm used to people saying to me, oh, come on, yeah, the Israelis, they're super smart. And I know lots of super smart Israelis, okay? And there's lots of super smart people from all kinds of places. But nationally, if you're treated in this way, you can make some really consequential missteps. And I passionately believe that Palestinians should get equality and get justice. But I sure as hell don't want to see Israel go the direction it's taking itself in. I want Israelis to be living in a country that A, doesn't treat Palestinians like that, but B, has a future, whether it's a future in whatever political dispensation. That's not what matters right now. What matters is that they are making some very serious miscalculations. The idea that they will cling on to America indefinitely, the idea that they can win exclusively by force, the hubris to think that the other side will always be inept, and Palestinian agency is a big question here. Eventually, the Palestinians will have to revive and renew their politics. But other surrounding countries, the idea that in Al-Aqsa, that's the image you want to broadcast to the entire Muslim world, of Jews dancing and celebrating in the Western Wall Plaza. I don't know if people have seen this image. Yes. It's worth looking up. As Al-Aqsa wasn't on fire, but there was smoke billowing from a small fire from the Al-Aqsa compound. How's that going to work out well for you? So I do come at this from a place of, please tell me, anyone who says, you know, I'm picking on Israel, it's a Jewish state, why don't you stand up for Israel? Please tell me how this works out well for you as someone who claims to care about a Jewish future in Israel.
We just have a couple minutes here, but let me just ask you this in terms of, you know, Netanyahu's political future and like what, like give people a sense of what you think happens with Netanyahu. And does that really fundamentally make a difference at this point? Right. I mean, you know, there was a time where we could talk about a really viable sort of like option to the right in Israel, but it doesn't really feel like the range of politics is almost maybe more narrow there than it is here in this regard.
Way more narrow. It feels like almost one large Jewish nationalist party across the spectrum with a couple of minor but noticeable differences. Netanyahu has, in this conflict, appears to have just played a get out of jail card in actually the literal sense of the term, because he's on trial right now. And the overnight news from Israel is that the attempts to form an alternative coalition, which would oust him, have collapsed. And the momentum has shifted in his direction. It doesn't mean he can form a coalition, but right now he is re-strengthened. And many Israeli commentators are saying that there is a causal connection between that and the escalation we have witnessed. But more importantly, yes, Netanyahu is the longest serving prime minister. When he goes, there will be some fluidity, some change, some unpredictability, but this goes so much deeper than Netanyahu. It is not about the person of Netanyahu. It is about rebuilding a progressive camp in Israel. You cannot have a progressive camp without a robust critique of the regime that it is trying to change. And you cannot have a progressive camp without incorporating the Palestinian citizens of Israel. There are some great individuals in civil society, Jewish and Palestinian, in that country working to change things. There are a couple of decent political leaders. I personally think the current leader of the Labour Party has a lot going for her. But she's going to have to shift her politics significantly and build on the wreckage that has been inherited. And it's about having a trenchant critique and a values-driven also realistic. It's about being a progressive realist in the Israeli context.
Daniel Levy, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to talk to you again. I wish it was under different circumstances. I feel like we end every one of our conversations that way. But thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. All
right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Finish up the week. Always good to catch up with Daniel Levy, and you know, he is a former diplomat, and is speaking to a very often, I think, you know, to a broad audience, but also his audience is that he speaks to is one that is supportive of Israel, and so in the most general sense. And so we've had very interesting perspectives on what is happening this week. And hopefully, at the very least, in the short term, the level of violence, the very least, drops over the course of, well, I would like it. I mean, if it were up to me, there would be a lot of different things that would change in the next 24 hours. But at the very least, I my heart goes out to the people who are under siege right now. And so we should just say that as we wrap up the week for our Peacock viewers. For them, for Emma and I, we will see you on on Monday, right? That's over the weekend.
I think that's how it works.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Thank you guys for backing me up on that whole weekend concept. All right. We will see you on Monday. And for those of you who are still with us, we're going to have in just a moment, we're going to bring in Noah Cohen. Alinos on the IM. Remember, you can IM the show via the app at majorityapp.com. You can also support the program. Oh, yeah, you get the app at majorityapp.com. You can support the program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We'll wait for Emma to get back before we bring on Noah. But Alinos asked me, Sam, you're measuring societal chain based on the feedback you get on Twitter? Really? I'm not measuring societal change on that, but I am measuring the discourse amongst where a lot of the media get their sense of what the discourse is. People get so narrow in their assessments of things. I mean, the broadly speaking, I don't think society cares too much about this. Our society, but most politics are largely fought, you know, amongst 10 to 20% of the people, 5 to 15% of the people. And a part of that politics, a big part of it, is a function of conventional wisdom and what the media says. And Twitter, as much as any other sort of, I guess, I don't know, place or space, influences the perspective of what the media you know, sort of perceives is going on. So
yeah, social media has its faults, but it definitely impacts things significantly.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, you can measure itself against itself, right? I mean, the idea that it may not be, I'm not saying there's a one-to-one relationship of what's going on, but broadly speaking, trends that you see on Twitter are not divorced completely from trends that are going on in society. So, you know, I mean, it's conceivable that Twitter has gotten to be a much more friendly place to the plight of the Palestinians and the rest of society, to the extent that there's any opinion. It has moved in the other direction, but I find that hard to believe. I find that hard to believe. So, all right, let's go. Want to welcome to the program Noah Colwin. He is the co-host of, or I should say the co-creator of Blowback, entering into its season two. Noah, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Here with Emma Vigeland.
How are you, Noah?
Doing well. I'm doing well.
Now, full disclosure, and I don't even know if you're aware of this, so it's also full disclosure and it's also enlightening you, but your show advertises on our show in the past, you know, via, you know, Stitcher, I guess.
Yeah.
So I feel like I should just say that up front so that I'm not accused of some type of pay for play type of situation.
Well, I was paying you to play. So this is a revelation to me in that sense. Right. No, but appreciate the disclosure. Yeah.
And then you will get a DM from me looking for a kickback.
Yes.
That's the way this works. That's the way we do this around.
Yes, it's exactly as simple as everybody on Twitter thinks it is.
So, all right. So last time, you guys did a season one of Blowback was about Iraq. And this time, what is it about?
So this season is about the Cuban Revolution and about the American government's attempts to stop it, which continue to this day. The frame of our story, the time that it takes place is, you know, we do in the same way that we did with the first season, which was about the Iraq War, in the same way that we did, you know, a couple episodes of prehistory prior to the invasion, or at least prior to 9/11, actually, not the invasion. You know, we do something similar here where we give a bit of a deeper dive and then we sort of tell the story of the revolution. And the idea being that I think, you know, in to put it in the simplest way, providing a counter history to the conventional narrative about what the Cuban Revolution was, you know, who the people that carried it out were, and, you know, what Cuba is today and what our relationship with it is.
And we should
say, meaning the American governments.
And when you say we, you're talking about Brendan James, your co.
Yes, my co-host, Brendan. Brendan does all of the producing and editing and sort of the sound, the sonic components. We both write in. We both write and research it together, but I do some more of the interviewing. But we're a two man show.
All right. So what is the? You tell me what the myth is. I mean, if it's a corrective in terms of the history, what is the sort of widely accepted story that is wrong?
So the story is that basically there was this guy prior to the Cuban Revolution named Fulgencio Batista, and this very popular broad revolution emerged to dislodge him. And then that revolution was betrayed by its communist leaders in the form of Fidel Castro, who then turned Cuba into a closed totalitarian society that can be characterized by poverty, cultural backwardness, and general sort of, you know, weirdness and isolation that we tend to associate with, you know, enemy regimes in this country that our government designates, like, you know, North Korea, for example. And that is, you know, I think that is sort of like the canned story. And then there's a, you know, like these sort of addendums that come into play about, like, you know, well, who are the Cuban American? What is the Cuban American community? And, you know, what is America's ongoing governmental policy toward Cuba and so on? And sort of what are the base kind of frames that we're sort of operating with?
And so what I mean, broadly speaking, I mean, people need to listen, right, to the show. But broadly speaking, what's wrong about that? What part do we get wrong about that history that you've just outlined? Batista was there. He was horrible. But what do we get wrong, broadly speaking?
So I think, like, the first thing is to, you know, Brendan and I have sort of, Brendan especially, as somebody who sort of clued me into this more seriously, about, like, the sort of original definition of the term neocolonialism as defined by Kwame Nkrumah, the president of Ghana. And basically, neocolonialism is sort of a good kind of very general term that you can use to describe the process by which, as, you know, older Western powers were decolonizing, the American-led order was able to create new systems of control and domination in their place. And so the real story is that in Cuba, America sought unsuccessfully to guide the revolution in a particular direction that would accommodate American interests, after having propped up Batista and many previous iterations of Batista, other dictators. And once Castro decided to do things as the leader of the revolution, such as a real aggressive land reform policy, right, nationalizing American-owned businesses, and a whole host of other social and economic reforms that were a little bit too socialistic for the American government, even if Castro himself did not identify as a socialist, though, of course, his brother was known as a communist and Che Guevara was in the leadership and so on. So, you know, there's this idea of the Cuban Revolution as a fundamentally malevolent force, when in reality, you know, as somebody said in a podcast that I was on this week, you know, I thought it was a good way of phrasing it, was actually like a second war of independence. You know, traditionally, the Spanish-American War is thought of as like Cuba's war of independence, because that's when the Republic of Cuba was created. But really, the Cuban Revolution was an act of separating Cuba from this colonial system where it churned out sugar and provided raw materials for the Americans, you know, who also owned all the other parts of Cuba, like tourism and so on. And, you know, it was a declaration of independence from that. And I think sort of then the next phase of our show is about all of the awful things that America resorted to in the subsequent years, up into, you know, the threat of nuclear annihilation to, you know, keep a hold on Cuba.
And we should say, right, it was Martí in that first independence.
Right. He's the canonical figure. He's like the
George Washington.
And he died in the course of that. And, you know, he's sort of famously his you know, there's a wonderful group of journalists based in Havana now called the Belly of the Beast, which is named after a quote of Martí's, because he said that he had lived in the Belly of the Beast as he had lived in America prior to the Spanish-American War. And he understood that while in the short term, you know, there was a, you know, no nominal alliance between the Cuban, you know, nationalists and the Americans against the Spanish, that eventually it would be the Americans, you know, who would be the next. As Muqtada al-Sadr might have put it, as we said in the first season, the great serpent.
Did the U.S. what was the U.S. disposition towards Batista? I mean, were they weren't. I mean, I know that they were that they thought the United States at that time foreign policy was, hey, Castro is somebody that we can work with. And then they started to like, hey, wait a second, why are you doing this? No, you're supposed to be our client type of situation. But what was it that was the breaking point? Was there a breaking point for the U.S. in terms of Batista, or was it like, oh, we can't stop this train, so we're going to try and guide it?
It's a bit of both. So it's funny because basically, while the earlier part of the Eisenhower years are sort of marked by this really aggressive policy of covert action and regime change, like we see, you know, most notoriously in Guatemala with the overthrow of the Guatemalan president, Jacobo Arbenz, by the CIA, By the end of the 50s, however, you know, John Foster Dulles has died, and Eisenhower, you know, he famously gives his exit address about the military industrial complex, which is less like a prescient warning and more like a very muted preemptive apology, for what it's worth.
Guys, you let the government get out of control with the military. So I just want to,
like, you were like supreme allied commander. You're like the highest, you're like, of all the guys who've ever had medals on their chest, like, you have the most, like, what do you talk, like, you know what I mean? Anyway.
Right. Sorry about what I did, but I would like to go down the history books as the guy who pointed it out. So,
right. So by 1959, it is understood, and the American government is basically, you know, they have offered Batista a way out. They're like, you've got to like transition this thing. And Batista resisted because Batista's government was itself, you know, there's a very, you know, the American mafia had a lot of interest in Cuba. But as we say in our show, the biggest racket of all was the Cuban government itself. And Batista, you know, profited immensely from that, you know, billions of dollars in today's money. And so obviously he was resistant to let go of his racket. And so by the time the revolution had become, you know, like was clearly gaining steam and had captured popular imagination in the international press, as well as the support of, you know, huge, you know, like the urban population, as well as the rural peasantry. You know, the writing was on the wall toward the end of 1959. And so it's very famously, as you see at the Second Godfather, you know, New Year's Eve, 1958, everybody, you know, gets shuffled out and Batista flees. He's not allowed to go to the U.S. because they're like, we gave you an out, dude. And he said no. And so then, you know, their first impression of Fidel is like, all right, you're the guy, like, you're the most popular figure in the country. Everybody looks up to you. You have made a lot of bold promises, and we're not going to rule out that you're somebody that we can guide. And so you have a lot of initial contacts in the course of 1959. You know, I mean, like, for example, Fidel goes on Ed Sullivan when he comes to the U.S. in 1959. By the time that visit happens in the spring, it's already sort of clear that, like, Fidel is not the American's guy. And Eisenhower does not visit him personally, but Nixon does. And, you know, there's this souring there. But, like, you know, the CIA caught themselves very flat-footed. There's a very famous meeting of a guy who was later involved in the Bay of Pigs, where he says he met with Castro and was like, this guy, anti-communist all the way. And, you know, which is, as we all know, is totally correct.
Yeah, I mean, right. But I mean, I think he at that time was just like, look, I realize that somebody has to be my patron, and I got to see which one is going to allow me the most space to be my patron. I think that was his perspective.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think it's a little bit like, I think that's just a little bit the cart before the horse, because I think it's more like he looked around him and was like, you know, the only way that we're going to make Cuba the place that I said it was going to be for this movement, and that we all agreed, and, you know, the July 26th movement, you know, was a part of, you know, giving land to the people, taking over industry, those things inevitably put it on a course of conflict with the U.S. Right. There was not really, like, I don't think that Castro really ever had a choice, because the things that the Cuban Revolution did that emancipated its people functionally and literally, you know, it also naturally put them on a course for collision with the U.S. It was sort of, the agency was in the American government's hand as to, you know, what relationship Castro might pursue, assuming that he had, you know, would want to remain, like, you know, officially non-aligned as he had in the early days.
All right. I got something for you that you may not know from your fancy schmancy podcast.
Oh yeah.
You ready for this? What was when he came for that UN talk, how did the Secret Service or whoever was providing the security detail, what was Castro's code name that they used to describe him?
I did know this, but I've forgotten.
Sugar One. Give you a sense of what they saw the value of Cuba at that point was.
Yeah, really. That's a very good and telling detail. I mean, it was a monocrop economy at that point, you know. It's the sort of, like, it's as classic an example as you get of it.
I've told the story, you know, my ex-wife did a documentary down there. So we went down there in, I guess it was 2002, and we're there for 4 or 5 weeks shooting. People can find it. I don't know how they can find that documentary, but it was about photography in Cuba. And we interviewed interviewed some of the folks that Castro enlisted to tell the story of the revolution in pictures. Corrales, we interviewed, I don't know if these names, but I cannot remember the name who took the iconic photograph of Che that is on all the t-shirts, but his assistant was alive when we went down there.
Whoa.
And so we spent a lot of time with him, and Corrales was the guy who took the photo of, from behind Castro as he's looking out, on everybody in, the square. You're aware of. But
it's really cool the way that we were able to interview Cubans for the show, and we were able to, we've since as the show has come out behind our paywall on Stitcher, we've been able to talk more and more with people who are in Cuba and or who are Cuban Americans, with people who know people in Cuba and who wanted, an alternative version of the story to be presented in some digestible way. And I think one of the things that's been really exciting as part of that, it really just has been this process of, getting to know Cubans and these people and see it for their island from their perspective in a way that you just don't get to see here, the fact is that this is recent enough history that as you literally experienced the people who were there,
right,
who did these things and participated, many of them are still alive and have some really amazing stories to tell. And it's a very recent phenomenon that you can directly communicate with people on the island with tools like WhatsApp and so on.
Was there anything that, in your conversation with the Cubans, was there anything that challenged maybe your assumptions about Cuba? Did you find stuff that, I think obviously the whole, the series is about challenging the, easily digestible, history, but was there anything that you found? So you had a certain skepticism to that, but was there anything that you found, in the conversations about Cuba that you found challenged your assumptions?
I think one of the, it's a really good question. I think one of the things that I found more that challenged my assumptions in talking to Americans than necessarily in talking to Cubans. I think in talking with Cubans, the stuff that really was sort of, because with Cubans, I went in with a more open mind. I really tried not to make a lot of assumptions because Brendan and I, our research process is that, we spend 6 months reading books and talking to some people, but steeped in kind of research, but we're not authorities on this stuff by dint of grad school or whatever. And so I think, with that, you sort of have to, to me, it was really important to not have assumptions. And so a lot of, I think, our views that we come to in the show were, if anything, animated and informed by the combination of what we sort of read, from both, not just mainstream and alternative sources, but, primary documents and from those conversations. And then with the Americans, it was a lot of, just learning about the different ways that our government could act that you didn't think that could before. And I don't just mean nefariously, just that our government is a very, even at that high level and during that era, was this very strange and weird thing that was documented really thoroughly in a way that our government isn't now. And you can learn a lot about it. And it was a very exciting thing. And that was revelatory for me. Just the history of it was very fun.
The way the government functions. I have to say that my experience down there, again, this is 20 years ago, and this, so, we're only 7-8 years out from when, and I think Cuba was just getting over the shock, essentially, of the fall of the Soviet Union, because they were devastated by,
right,
that.
And I think to illustrate what that means, just to flesh that out a bit, it was since 1962, when Kennedy initiated the embargo, Cuba is not allowed to do trade functionally with the U.S. government and any American allies. And so, in a lot of ways. And so when you think about what that means then, when, all right, in a bipolar world, when one of the powers that was your buddy disappears, what happens overnight? Cuba, which is a country with limited natural resources and, not really, it's not, it's not like Germany. It's not like France. It's not a country that like should something like that happen to, you know, the rug get pulled out from under it as Germany did. It could, you know, come together. That wasn't an, you know, that wasn't an option. And so the Cuban, you know, it was a period of increased repression is as commonly understood, the special period in the 90s. But it was also, you know, a direct cause of the continuation and intensification of the American war on Cuba during that time as well. And you know, it's an incredible thing that Cuba came out of it.
Right. It was a lot of deprivation and a lot of austerity.
Yeah. And needless, like entirely a consequence, because, you know, it just
entirely a consequence of the ability. They didn't have the ability to do trade with this massive engine of trade that is, you know, 60 miles, 100 miles off their coast.
Essentially. 90, man. It's 90 miles from Florida.
Well, 60 to 100. I mean, I got it. I got within
that. I mean, I'm a man of precision. You see,
I understand. Well, I mean, that is the thing, and I also like, you know, it was interesting. There were both things that surprised me in terms of like, you know, what you'd hear in the United States in terms of like how deprived people were, but also there was like a decent amount of propaganda there, and there were people who were a little bit afraid. I accidentally put the production on the radar of the Ministry for Counter-Revolution by having a conversation with a guy in flip-flops and a tank top, and all of a sudden we were being followed. There was a statute that was just down from the American annex, which I thought was fascinating. I've told this story many times, but it also made me very, very sensitive to the propaganda we were seeing in this country, because this was in 2002. So I came back from there like in January, February of 2002, I think it was, I can't remember exactly. And to a country that was in full on propaganda measure. I mean, it was nuts. And
I mean, we covered this in our show, but, you know, 2002, John Bolton gives a speech at the Heritage Foundation saying, you know, we have reason to believe that Cuba has the capacity to develop, you know, biological weapons. And yeah. And which was a, you know, a bullshit, vacuous, amorphous statement, because he was saying it that like, well, the Cubans would have the option and capacity to do so if they so chose. Maybe they will, maybe they won't, blah, blah, blah. Like they've never expressed an inclination. There had never been an accusation. Like it was total bullshit. And he says this to a room full of right wingers. Then when he gets subpoenaed, or he's asked by, you know, Chris Dodd to go before the Senate, Colin Powell says no. Colin Powell tells Dodd he can't have him. And so he sends a scientist. And you know, we this is in the beginning of the first episode of the new season, but it's like, yeah, I mean, there was an active, you know, and this is as the rafts are coming. It's on the heels of Elian Gonzalez. It was active then in a way that I think we're actually starting to see a little bit now, unfortunately.
Right. And I mean, it was also, I mean, I meant the propaganda just like broadly about 9/11, you could see reflected down there. Yeah. But in terms of Elian Gonzalez, there is a statue that is like, I don't know, maybe 500 yards from the American annex or whatever it is. They didn't call it the embassy at the time because we didn't have formal relations. And it's Martí. And it is, you know, like it's like got that copper sheen where it turns green, and the base was made out of cement and it was like crumbling. And so he's holding a baby. And he's got his arm out pointing at the embassy, essentially, basically saying like, you can't have my child. And you go up to that statue, right? And this is like 2002. The child he's holding is Elian Gonzalez. They have made the statue that couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 years old look like it's been there for 100 years. It was fascinating. Like you could see, like they had purposely denigrated the cement, and they made it look like it was 100 years old. And they had brought, you know, Martí 100 years into.
This is a very, you know, it's a, for many Cubans, this is a very sensitive. It's a sensitive issue for a couple of reasons. So for one thing, I will say we will have as a bonus episode of this season an interview with Jose Pertierra, who is the lawyer for Elian Gonzalez's father, as well as an advisor on the Cuban Five case. And Jose is fucking awesome. And it's going to be a great interview. And I'm really excited to get that out. So second, you know, it's a sensitive issue because in 1960, after the Cuban Revolution succeeds and after the American government sort of openly declares its hostility, formally, they sever ties, Eisenhower sever ties in January 61, like 2 weeks before Kennedy takes over. And, you know, but at the beginning of 1960, it's the beginning of a more subtle, but, you know, gradually intensifying effort. And one operation that was a CIA plot administered by Americans and American sympathetic Cubans was who are mostly upper class was called Operation Peter Pan. And it was basically they spread stories and active disinformation originated with the CIA, acknowledged in various declassified records and so on and journalistically. And they, you know, told parents like, look, like your children are going to get sent to Soviet totalitarian relocation farms. And like, you're not going to see them again. And like, that's what Castro is going to do. 14,000 children, you know, in not that big of a country go to the US are separated from their parents. And, you know, like, because of the nature of just like what Cuban diaspora politics are, what they are, many of those children have grown up and said like, oh yeah, I'm happy to have made it to America. But like, you know, those are children who were separated from their parents. And there are a lot of them who did suffer. They were in foster homes. You know, they suffered severe trauma, to say nothing of what happened to their family and the absence that they experienced to their family. So then when you flash forward to the Elian Gonzalez case, you know, which is in brief, just, you know, a woman and her boyfriend, who is a coyote, take their son, with whom she does not have custody, away from his school and then puts him on a raft. With her, everybody dies except for him, miraculously survives. For whatever reason, American authorities decide to give him into the custody of family that he's never met. And in America, the story is that like, we're sending him back to North Korea, to Hitler. We're right. Sending him back to Hitler. And it's not this story of like, oh no, this is just the latest effort of the Americans to take our children. You know, like right. There's a very, like there and, is and, another and to be clear, side.
His dad lived in Cuba.
Yes,
his dad was a
custody battle. And this father was, you know, I'll let Jose talk about his client, you know, and Elian's father. But like, this was not a case of like, oh, there is not a single defensible part of what she did. And the story that we tell in America is one that is centered around the American 2000 election, and it is centered around the, you know, like, cute, you know, angry exiles, all, both of which, you know, are things that are real dimensions of it. What is never talked about is how you could view the Elian Gonzalez case as yet another example of the extent to which the American government is willing to prostrate itself to fuck with the Cuban Revolution and the Cuban government and the Cuban people, again through their children. And you know, it's a very that's how I would put it.
It is so hard to express how much of a big deal this was in this country. I mean, like it was like the second sort of like. There was a couple of these during that time, but it was like OJ and then Elian. Like there was people in the streets and surrounding the house. And when, you know, Janet Reno was a household name because of him, I mean, it was the insanity of that time. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's, I don't know.
Well, I mean, but it's not like it's important that we not like, you know, yes, that was like that time, but there's a lot of continuity with today. And yeah. I think that's important to point out. So, you know, for example, I think that one of the things that people don't know about is that the National Endowment for Democracy, which is, you know, the private organization through which the American government gives money to support things like Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, but I know it's for sure Radio Free Europe and other, you know, what they would call American information services, but are effectively American propaganda, you know, of varying quality and severity. And the, you know, we still to this day pay millions of dollars a year to support Cuban anti-Cuban government propaganda from Miami that is effectively keeping on the dole a bunch of, you know, like right-wing Cuban exiles. And, you know, this is, you know, people have for years been saying, oh, there's a new generation of Cuban Americans, things are changing and so on. But like, there's, you know, like it's people who are arguing along those kinds of demographic or generational lines are not making a serious argument, because what is still there is this infrastructure that continues to amplify this stuff and all of the noxious political incentives that gets everybody from the mayor of Miami, who is, it's a figurehead position and he's a Republican shitheel, but you know, it's, he's still an influential guy, that gets everybody from him to Bob Menendez, you know, always so riled about Cuba. There is a, it's not dissimilar to the Israel lobby, which is, you know, where I spent the other majority of my journalistic career, you know, reporting on and developing authority. You know, they are functionally the same way, in the same way that all lobbies are. And I think it's important to recognize that, that, you know, this view that we have of Castro and our policy, it's not from time immemorial. It's shaped and maintained by an active set of interests.
Noah Cullen, thank you so much for joining us. Folks want to hear the blowback. They go to what, Stitcher?
Yes. So I can do the pitch this time, so you don't have to.
Well, you can. And I just want to say this before you do. Apparently, Cuba's 94 miles from the Florida Keys. So, I mean.
Okay, fine. Whatever.
Gotcha.
Fine. Whatever. Gotcha. We'll talk about it later.
I got my gotcha.
Anyway, you go to stitcher.com/premium, and then you sign up for a monthly plan with the code blowback. Now, here's the thing. It will tell you that you're just getting a week free. That's a lie. You're actually getting 5 weeks free. There's a glitch in their system. So you're supposed to just get a month, but actually you're getting 5 weeks until they fix it. Then you're just getting a month. But
they can't fix this?
I listen, man, I don't make the rules. I don't make the technology. I'm merely a purveyor of fine content. And in that role, I'm telling you, I want to maximize the gains of this audience. And signing up for Stitcher obviously helps support the show.
Whoa. We can also use the code majority.
I forgot. You can also use the code majority. Yeah. Please use the code majority. Use the code majority. I mean, I've been gracious enough to have me here.
Yeah, exactly. Let's make it like we just had to, like, why do we get this bump? Because they don't know that you're on here. We got this huge bump on
Friday. I mean, it's and listen, it's if you go and listen to Blowback with that code, it's great for us anyway.
Yeah, there you go. Of course. Folks will forgive you for that being 4 miles off.
So. I mean, I listen, if it puts me on
apparently
your blacklist,
that wasn't in
I
one
understand
of your books that you read.
Yeah. Ooh. I'm gonna have to sit with that one, man.
Noah, thanks so much for your time today. Folks can check it out. Go stitcher.com, search for Blowback, use the coupon code majority, get secretly 5 weeks off.
Thanks, man. 5 weeks.
All right, thanks for coming on. Say hi to Brendan.
Bye.
All right. Emma had to drop out. I didn't want to talk to Noah. Emma was here. I just didn't.
Well, I mean, clearly I didn't want to talk to him either. There you go.
Yeah, we can get it.
Emma has strong feelings about the Cuban Revolution.
We'll go into the
fun half. We've got a Jersey rivalry, too, the two of them.
Oh, obviously.
We'll go in the fun half, and Emma can talk about her corrective to their corrective on the history of Cuba and the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I was off camera, but I got the mileage exactly right, so...
There you go. Boom. Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, not only do you get the free show free of commercials, you also get the fun half and you keep this show trucking along. Despite the fact that we do this pay-for-play shit like we did with Blowback.
Trucking.
There you go. Also, don't forget, check out Nomi's show. YouTube.com/TheNomiKey Show. And remember, you can watch us on YouTube, on Twitch. My understanding is we got a level 3 hype train on Twitch today. So we got that
going
for us.
Poggers.
Oh, total poggers. You kidding?
Yeah.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, last night, David and I on Left Reckoning had Matt Huber on to discuss two of his pieces. First, in Jacobin, rich people are fueling climate catastrophe, but not mostly because of their consumption. Basically, you know, it's nice to hate rich people because of their yachts and stuff, but really it's their relationship in production that we should really be focused on. And also, there's still no shortcuts to climate change. And then we reflect on, you know, sort of all the Michael Brooks people have been seeing in the timeline in the past few days with regards to his statements on Israel-Palestine. And yeah, we kind of talked about that a little bit. So check that out last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Also, I am going to Twitch stream probably tonight at Literary Hangover, twitch.tv/literary hangover. So check that out.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.